Can you guys hear me? All right, so we'll get going. It's 8:30, so thank you, everyone, to joining us this nice morning with good traffic for anybody who had a further hotel. That was not an easy drive-in. So today what we'll talk about is how to implement a release pipeline with release management. So we'll also discuss a little bit, for those who saw the keynotes yesterday, about our integration with desired state configuration. So we announced yesterday that going forward, release management will also work with desired state configuration for PowerShell. So basically, the session will go over what's release management, kind of the basics, and then we'll focus a little bit on our integration with DSC. We have another session next Wednesday where we'll go more in detail on how to really exploit and get into deeper scenarios with release management. So my name is Claude Rémillard. I'm the program manager for release management. And with me, I have Arun. If you want to present yourself.
Can you hear me? Yep. Hi, I'm Arun Chandrasekhar. I'm a program manager for DevTest Labs, which is underlying some of the release management work.
All right, so what we'll do, actually, so I'll start with a night story. Actually, what we think of a night story is, it's actually Knight Capital. It's an investment firm in financial services on the NYSE, on the New York Stock Exchange. I'm trying not to do all acronyms there. And these guys were doing a new order and link system. So basically, often you want to go buy a bunch of things, and on the stock exchange, they'll go and break that into a lot of child orders, and it's basically calculating everything at the right time, and on those fractions, make significant dollars on big things. So they replaced some of the old code they had in their system with this new version of it. However, they had kind of kept in the back of their system the old code. It was never cleaned up. Somewhere along the way, they decided to reuse one of the flags they had from the old code into the new code, so in dev. And then they basically went and did the deployment. So it was a manual deployment with not a lot of documentation. And basically, somebody had to copy the new flags, set the new flags everywhere on their 8 prod servers and copy the new code and whatnot, and then they went live. They started losing $172,000 a minute. The flag on server number 8 actually started the old code that was still somewhere in the system. And then they started to try and fix it. They had no documentation, they had no way to roll back, they didn't have any logs or whatnot. So they ended up losing $460 million. And they ended up under bankruptcy protection. So deployment's important. This is kind of an extreme case. And behind that, like, whatever bad deployments or a faulty pipeline or the inability to roll back or the inability to go and diagnostic when you have issue means to you, whatever the impact is, it might be interruption of services, it might be take your company bankrupt, it might be opening security issues or internal user not getting, you know, systems working. It's kind of important at different levels. So that might be a more extreme case. But basically, the thing is, what we want to do with this is to be able to go reliably and do it efficiently and be able to, what we call, fail elegantly. So basically, that's in the organization, what's your impact? So I'm assuming if you're here, you care in some way, shape, or form about that pipeline. The other thing is, how do we know so much? And that's kind of the formula I found. There's nothing funny about the story, but this bit is interesting. Is how do we know so much about all these details? You know, it's kind of private company with private things. Actually, what happened is, at some point when they went bankrupt, somebody said at the Security Exchange Commission, what, are you telling me you lost $500 million for a faulty flag? I mean, you guys ran away with the money, right? And actually, the SEC did a full investigation to go figure out if it was true that that's how they lost the money. And actually, it was true, and you have, if you go to the SEC, you find a 28-page worst bug report in history, I think, that you can read. So how do we think about release management, you know, in that context? So I'll just say how we think about it from a Microsoft perspective and where we're going with that. You've seen some variation of this guy a few times. So basically, we have the development side, we have the operational side, and basically, we've been tooling and working a lot on the development side or the green side. And actually, with Agile, we've improved our cadence on it. So we're going faster. We're coming every 2 weeks, 3 weeks with new versions. The right side has a lot more constraints that you have to do. It's interesting, on the left side, we're basically saying, our job is to make the most changes the fastest we can. New features, correct bug, and whatnot. The right side is, make sure everything works, so allow the least change as possible, because that's usually when you change things where you have more risk. And basically, we end up with a difference of cadence on both sides and things piling up in between the two. So often, the way to go from the dev to ops is complex, lots of different things, lots of little flags. It might be error-prone, and it's often like a lot of chaos, emails, coordinations, and whatnot, like the big weekend where we're pushing the big production and whatnot. So our answer to all that is really to try to automate the flow. So we're really looking at, the goal is to go more often to production, do it in a safe way, and be able to fail elegantly. So it's really what we're thinking about when we're looking at it. So how can we make that flow happen often? So that, you know, I have a new feature, I want the users to be able to have value from it, then I can push it to production and everybody feels safe about it, and I can do it more often. There's also a cost thing. If we automate, it's not costly to go through all the stages. So then I can actually go through all the stages all the time and do all my tests, and again, minimize my risk because I've automated the whole process. So when we look at RM, or release management, we do like kind of four main things with the software. So the first one is really to automate the deployment on these stages. One of the concepts we have there is this idea of, we call it a release path or a release pipeline, which is, you know, the stages I need to go through on my way to production. And we're based on this idea of, we build once and deploy many times. You can build in between, so you can have like smaller pipelines, but ideally you'd want to have that long pipeline where you say, well, I'm going to build once. And in theory, you have a succession of tests in each of these environments that make sure that your code works and it works well in the environment. So one of the idea there is that, hey, I'm going to deploy often to dev, find a bug, go do a new version, try dev again, and then eventually to integration, find a bug, go back to dev. So you'll deploy a lot in dev and integration and QA, and you won't deploy as often in prod. So the logic we're trying to do is, if I automate the whole thing, if the only variation I have are just like data based on which IP on which environment, I want to test my prod mechanism as early as I can in my pipeline so that it's been exercised. I know it works. We've tried it over and over. So by the time I get to prod, it might be the 200 or 2,000 time I'm actually running my code, running my scripts and everything. So that's kind of the idea to try and get there. And the key is as early as possible. In real life, you'll transition slowly. You'll bid it and you'll get it earlier and earlier. But that's the way we think we should go, and that's what we're tooling for. The other thing also on the previous slide is, and we want to have a one-click deployment. So we want one person to say, I want to deploy in this environment that there's no manual intervention. So somebody just click and it installs. The other thing we do is to automate the approval workflow. So I'll show that in my short demo. So we can say, before I deploy to an environment, somebody can approve or not. After I've deployed into an environment, we can send emails to the tester to say, now the app is ready for you in this environment, go and test it. And then once they're done, they come back to the system and they say, yeah, now you can go to the next environment. So let's say QA says, yes, everything is good, you can go into prod. I don't need anybody technical. Just last approver goes, yes, you can go, then it deploys in prod, and we're done. So that's the second thing, is really to be able to set that workflow. Third thing I talked a bit about, but it's this idea of being able to use the same mechanism and to deploy the same way to all environment. And you'll see we have a logic in there of setting variables and then specific values per environment. We'll do swapping of variables in your command lines and files on each of the targets so that my core mechanism I'm using is the same throughout. Ideally, my environment should be the same throughout, and that's where the DSC comes in play, and we'll talk more about that. Last point, which is a key concept in RM, is the idea of the full traceability. So what we do is every time we have a new version of the code, so we just created a build, and in many cases, we can start a release. We create a separate specific release transaction. And that release transaction is the one you're going to follow through all the stages. So you'll be able to see where it is. That's what you'll approve or cancel and reject or as it goes through the pipeline. On that release transaction, it's going to be unique for every version. We'll try to capture your logs, your configurations, your approvals, so that at the same time the release transaction is your tracking entity. It also replaces the emails or the piece of paper that you get to sign before you get to pre-prod or prod or whatnot. So we're trying to have that full traceability. And also the ability to say, well, I want to see this is the last release that went in production, then I'm able to see these are the files that we use, these are the configuration we use, here's who approved and whatnot. So basically wrap everything together. So that's this idea from the traceability. So that's kind of the four big things that we do in there. When we look at what we do on a stage, and part of it is things we do now and things we're thinking about and investing in doing. So what you need to do on the stage is, first thing, when you think release as a whole, it's not just installing bits. It's actually either configuring your environments as well, maybe creating them as you go. And then the next step is you put your bits on it, you configure your bits, IIS, whatnot, that you need to do. Then you need to create test data. You run some automated tests, maybe some manual tests or not, so that depends on your level of automation. And that's kind of a small parenthesis there. The more you do automated testing, the faster your pipeline will be. Often in your pipeline, it's really how long does it take you to do the different steps that you have. So that's another area of investment, is obviously automated testing to make your pipeline go faster. And then once we're done with all these tests, we can come back to the system, approve if we need. If we're fully automated, automated tests pass. I don't need any manual approvals. You just go on to the next step. And then, you know, we do notification and approval as we need. So that's how we're looking at it. So basically when we look, we're looking at that full stack and we're looking at being able to trigger everything we can from release for all these different aspects of the stack. So I'll get into more how it works. So we can start releases a couple of ways. We can manually start a release. We go to the UI. So we have actually two UI at the top. We have a web client, which is more for my approvers on the pipeline. So it might be, you know, often I think about Betty in accounting who looks at the system and makes sure that we fixed everything properly and the feature is fine. It can be a product owner. It can be a tester. It can be, you know, some people in development if in the first few stages. So we have a web approval, which is purpose for approving and going on the pipeline. And we have a desktop client, which is where we configure everything, where my release manager would work, where you configure environments, track releases, and so on and so forth. I just stopped because I tend to say so on and so forth a lot. And it was pointed to me yesterday. So now I just said it, and I pause, and I say, ah, I said it. All right. So you get a point every time I say it. All right. The next thing is the release management server. It's a SQL database behind with our services. It's a separate server than TFS right now, so we plan eventually to have it available on VSO and as part of TFS. So that's not a big secret. The big secret is when. Like, so everybody will ask me when. I don't know yet. But we're working in that direction. So logically, in many cases, the way it's created is build will run. In build, we just add a line that says if you reach that point in team build, you go and trigger a release in IAM. So build will drop the files, and then IAM will take them and then move them through all the different environments through the workflow. Or I can start them manually. Or we have an executable that you can start with another build system or another system that you trigger. So basically, that will create the releases. So let's say I come in as a user, I go to the web, and I approve to go to the next stage. I want to go to QA. All my test and dev are done. I might have five components that needs to go to my environment. Let's say a SQL database, a few services, a web client. So when we think release, we think about releasing an app, not just components. So the way it works is, on the target servers, we have deployers. So that's the little squares on top. So the deployers will actually pull the components they need from the server, bring them down on it, and every deployer will install the components they have. Once every deployer has deployed all the components we need, then we'll consider the stage deployed, and we'll continue with the workflow. If one of them fails, we'll trigger the rollback procedures we have, and then we'll roll back on all the servers, basically. So either, for us, it's either they all work or they don't work. So that's kind of the principle that works. And these deployers are on the target machine, and they pull from the server. So actually, the deployer needs to have access to the server. The server does not need to have access to the target. So that, for example, you don't need to give prod access to the security using your IAM server. So that's kind of the how it all works. So what I'll do is I'll show it. I'll demo a few of the basics. Oh, thank you. I'll get onto my VM. All right. So right now I'm inside of the WPF client, the Windows client. So the app is kind of structured. If we go over the logic we went. So I have the release tab where I track my release transactions. So these are the different releases. I have the configure path. This is where I'll configure. These are the stage for my app. These are the servers I'm using, my approvers. I almost said whatnot, and I didn't. All right. And then I have configure apps. This is where I'm actually configuring my components and how they deploy on each of those servers that I have. Inventory is where we have the different tools we can use. So that comes in the box, and that's also extendable. And then in admin, we have security and all these different things. So if I look, for example, in this case, I have two apps actually. Usually, you'd create a pipeline per app or maybe a group of app, which are the different stages that you need to go through. So in the overview, we kind of look at it by stage. And then I can actually go in and look at one of on that pipeline on dev. These are the release transactions that went through dev. And I'm looking, the last one installed in dev is this guy. So that's the last transaction that went there. And those are the one that went before. And for example, this one actually made it all the way to prod. So I'll just go and open that specific one transaction. I'll just bring that up here. I just changed. Let me resize it a little bit. All right. So that's my unique transaction. Actually, it was triggered by build at this time and date. And when we open it, we go into the view log. So we see the log of what happened to that specific release transaction. So here, we see in the sequence, I did some things in dev, QA, and prod. Actually, at this level, the different steps, those would be approval steps. So the web team actually automatically approved there. So they own this environment, but they decided not to manually approve. So you can set approval automatic or manual. So we just went through it. Then we did the deployment. And here's the detail of my deployment. So we did these four actions. You know, remove the site. We made a copy. Then we installed our call center site. And then we created the website. And if I look at the call center site step, these are the files that we copied that we add on the target server. So the key is this comes from the target server. So the deployer takes the information, does the work, and everything that would come on screen, basically we capture into the log, and we bring it back to the transaction so that, again, if there's an issue, you can quickly go look at those different logs. So copying file is not very complicated, and I don't have an example there. But if you're if you have a more complex tool that does the deployment, or if you added your own tool and you have a log in addition to what you would see, if you have a log file on the target server, you can say, yeah, bring it back to. So in that case, it would appear here beside it. So actually, you can get access to that log file to do your diagnostic. So those are the things that we've executed. And then we kind of went and went through the same thing in QA and so on and so forth. Number two, all right. So how we followed it, we actually have the sequence, and that's what, when we configure our deployment, is we configure those sequences. So at release time, we take a snapshot of our configuration of our deployment. We snapshot it on the transaction. So if you change it later, we can always go back and say, well, my deployment for 3 weeks ago, what was it at the time? So that's the snapshot here. And here you see kind of what we had configured. For example, in that case, remove the site, copy the file. Why we do that is actually because here, after creating the site and starting my site, I also have a rollback procedure, in this case, taking my backup and restarting the site with the backup. So in case it failed, this is what I would have done in case of failure. We have another type of action, which is called manual intervention, that we can put either in the deployment or in the rollback, which says stop, and we send an email to say, go investigate, something went wrong. So that's another option. So for example, if you start doing a deployment in prod of your SQL update script, I'm not sure you can put anything very smart in that rollback box. So we'll execute what you want to happen in case of problem, but you need to decide what you want to happen, and sometimes it's a manual intervention. Go investigate and do a roll forward, which might be the right action in that case. And if you notice here, for different stages, I will have different information available. Here, I'm using different variables. So the logic we have is we'll set some variable like site name and these, and we'll put the value for each of the environment. And let me resize that a little smaller again, so I'll get my bottom of the screen. So that's this idea of configuration variables. So if I'm looking at the site, my call center site, I only use three variables here. And the logic is we put that configuration, those are the values we'll use. So when we bring the bits to the target server, we'll open the config file and do a replacement of the different variables that we have there with the values we specify here. And here's really, those are the values that were used at deployment time for that specific release. And we show them side by side. We found that often when something goes wrong, the first thing you look is it different from the other environment network? So what were the differences? Sometimes they're valid, sometimes it's a typo. So it's easy. Also, when you set it up, you can cut and paste from one to the other, which actually removes some of those issues. The other thing we also tag on the release is, this is the build that I used, the project, the build that was my source that triggered it. This is the build number, and the importance of the build number is that I know this guy is one to prod. This is this build number. I can go on the build number, and again, if I can see all my check-ins, if I link my work items to my check-ins, then I can see all the work items for what I want in prod. So you really get that check-in to prod line end-to-end. And this is the package location where actually the files were dropped. And when we take over from release, we actually override the retention so that those files are protected, so that we can keep them. That's usually where I stop and say any questions, but we'll keep the questions for the end. So I'll show briefly how we configure this. And I'll just do a quick time check. All right. So I went to the configure path. So this is where I configure again. So we saw the transaction, we'll approve. The one thing I haven't showed is the approval. So I said we have a web client for the approvers. So when I'm set to approve on a stage, I'll get an email with a link to this web client where I'll see what I have to approve or previous releases. And on this one, I can see this is the component that is included in that deployment. This is the bill number that I would approve. These are the approvals requested. Here's who would approve next. And again, we have that, you know, accept that before installation, approve to install, validate, and I'll show that in a second. But we found that people often want to know who approved this and who will look at it after me. So we're giving you kind of that context. And what is it I'm approving? It's this build, these components of this app. And then from there, we can go and approve or reject it or reassign. So we could put an approver as a group. Somebody from that group, let's say QA, might look at this and say, well, I'm reassigning to Arun to work on that. Then he'll get an email saying you're the approver for this. So it helps with the team manager. Then you can type a comment, approve it, and then you go forward. The pre-deployment approval also adds a couple of fields, which is a time and date for the actual approval to take effect or the deployment to happen. So I can approve today at 2 p.m. this afternoon, but it's going to deploy tonight at midnight or Saturday or whatnot. So you can delay the actual action happening. Yes?
So is that, can that be automated so that, for example, if you have blackout dates and blackout times, that you have that as some sort of calendar or schedule?
Right. No, not yet. So your approver needs to know them and approve in consequence, but it's a requirement we've heard in our backlog. Yeah, it's kind of the next step, right? All right, so I'll just go quickly. So when we define our pipeline, we create a stage. Stage, we'll link to an environment, and Arun will show more about the environment. So really, you define the group of servers, you group them into an environment, and you say, well, that QA stage is on this environment, which is a group of servers. Environment can be shared between pipelines. So prod is prod, and my multiple pipelines going to prod. So that's why we made a distinction between the stage and the physical environment itself. And then we set those pre-deployment notification, validation, and post-deployment approval. So usually at the bottom, those would be the people responsible for testing before we go forward. And you could say for here, I'm adding Brian needs to approve, Brian specifically, and somebody from the QA team. And once I have those two approval, then we're going to go to the next one. And then if there's a manual approval here, then you would need to approve before we continue. Or if it's automated, we'll just run through and continue forward. In a continuous deployment, if I had everything in automated test, I would probably need no approval at all. So if it deploys and it runs my tests and it's fine, then I'll just go on to the next environment. For example, us internally, that's how we use it. If the first stage, there's no approver. It's either passes or fail the test. The stage type is also important. You define it in the admin. It's important because QA means QA for everyone, but also we have security throughout the application. So we can say this team can only look at edit QA stage, or prod is only this group who can look at it, and dev is only this group. So we relate security on who can see what based on the stage type. Again, so that you can have, because on the same object, we have prod, dev, and QA working on the same object. So that's the way we do that. We can also, the other aspect is where are we configure app. We create release template, and we have the same thing. We can see who can see which release template. And who can see which release template is important. If we have a 40 apps, or then I'm a developer and I'm working on three apps, I'll only see the three apps that I need and only the releases related to my three apps. Because you'll get a lot of release transactions, those little release trial. If you do it every check-in, like a lot of teams do, then it means you'll have multiple per day. So if you have multiple app, multiple team, it's going to add up. And the idea is then you only want to see what's relevant to you. So I'll go into my, again, that's a one-time definition you do for your app that will decide how you automate. So it looks as we saw when we did the transaction, we made a copy with the values at the time. So here I'm into the editor. So this is the one we looked at, and I have dev, QA, and prod. I can copy a deployment sequence from one environment to the other, but we can modify them. I might have a lot more servers in prod than I have in dev, for example. And often I'll do things in prod that I don't need to do in dev. In dev, I can recreate things and override things. In prod, I might not. Ideally, you want to recreate prod and then apply your deployment to it as part of your stage. So when we create those, let's say I'll add a sequence here. So we have control flow things that we can do. For example, here I can say I want to go in parallel, and I want to go on. I only have one server in my example, but let's say if I had multiple servers, they would appear here. Or we have a concept of tag. Arun will show where it represents a group of server. So here I would say, all right, in parallel, I want to do these two things. And then in sequence, I'm going to continue with these. And let's say I want to deploy my call center component. So the components here are your app. You'll define those. You can go and add multiple components, or you can just go and edit your component. And that's where you'll define things like, what's my source? Is it from a shared drop location? Is it from another build? Or is it in the same build of the rest of the app? You'll define, am I deploying it? In this case, it's an Xcopy. It could be a DAC pack, a number of different things. And this is extendable in the inventory. We can add additional things. But we have a number of them. And here you see those tokens I was talking about, like installation path. That's the one I'll then specify values per environment. For example, also we could say, well, before installation, go into the drop that we got, go in star.config, and look for a value there for user, and look for a value for, let's say, password. And you can also say, well, this guy, though, it's a secret, so I want it encrypted. We'll encrypt it on the database. We'll encrypt it on the line as well. We use a semantic key for all our communication. And so that's how you define my component. These are the things. So when you configure it, when you drag it, then that's what will appear here in the details, the information you'll need to fill. And again, the same thing, you can look at the variables here to set them on all your commands and all your components. So we have a number of pre-done things in there. We have the manual intervention I mentioned earlier, which would be send an email with this instruction to this person or this group. And the only difference is in the web client, there's an extra button which reads instructions where they click on it, and the content of that box will be there. So for example, this deployment just failed, go and investigate.
Is there any way to connect
or migrate environments that you have a predefined on NPM employee to do management? Not at this stage. All right. And then you have like all these different actions that are pre-done for you, like IIS and SQL and so on and so forth. Number three. All right. I'm so self-conscious about it. It's crazy. All right. Let's get back in the flow.
So, Claude, just a quick question. Like, when you're talking about the components, right, what are the kind of servers from which we can get the builds? Because that's a question that came up quite a bit in the booth yesterday.
So
what kind of TFS connections do we support?
Yeah, so we can support connecting actually from TFS 20, 10, 12, 13, and from VSO. And from a drop location from a third party. So you can receive a file from an email, drop it in there, and then just invoke with our executable, and then we'll start. But obviously, you won't get the link on this is the build and that full traceability if you manually drop files. So the integration with TFS is more interesting. All right. So what we're at, and again, the last point is we can actually go, and I'll just close this, and we can go and add to that inventory. We can add, so we have all these pre-done actions, and then you can create your own actions. You have a test harness, you want to create a PowerShell to start your own test, you'll just add it as a tool. It will appear in the toolbox. You decide on which category. You can add categories, and then you can do it. Our Wednesday session, we'll do a lot of these examples. We'll show how to do a tool for adding SSIS and adding specific deployment to Azure. So for this, we'll go in more detail. What we'll do this morning, though, is I'll turn it over to Arun. So what we're adding is actually a new way or an alternate way of doing our deployment. So when we go into the deployment of the app, instead of doing all the actions that we have. Now we're adding the ability to use a DSC script, a desired state configuration script, to do that deployment. And I'll just turn it over to Arun so that he can actually go and show us that. So I'll just bring that over to you.
Yeah. How many of you attended the session on disaster state configuration yesterday? Show of hands. Oh, good. Okay. So let me just do a very brief introduction. Then looks like a lot of you are familiar with DSC. So what is desired state configuration? Typically, when a developer is trying to develop like a deployment logic for an application, you start with an assumption of the target environment, right? That this is the state of what my target environment that I'm deploying my application to looks like. Then you run a series of actions. You say, okay, these are the things I need to do to deploy my application. And then you end with the desired state, hopefully, because you don't know whether that assumed state is true, and you don't know where, like how good these set of actions are to get it to the desired state. So what DSC brings to the table is to kind of flip it around a little bit and say, you start with sending a description of the desired state of your environment, of what you want your end state of your environment to look like, to the actual environment that you're sending it to. And then the DSC engine figures out how to reach that desired state. So how does this happen? So the primary sort of magic here is pretty straightforward. It's basically a notion of federation on each machine, where each machine basically understands what its current state is, which is the get. So it's just getting its current state. And then there's some test to see, okay, am I at the desired state that is being proposed? Am I in the configuration that is being proposed? And then if I'm not, then there is a set which says that, okay, I will go ahead and set myself to the desired configuration. So effectively, the set does the magic of make it so, right? And how does the make it so happen? So the description of the desired state is very simple, declarative configuration. So there has to be some logic that sits behind it, and that sits in a bunch of DSC resources that are easily composable, reusable, and consumable across a lot of different situations. So they're very fundamental resources, like how do you deploy a website or a database in an incremental, idempotent fashion. And all of them implement the get, test, set kind of interface. And over a period of time, you can start building out these resources. There are already like quite a lot in the wild. Like you'll see the PowerShell team and a bunch of MVPs who have posted over 50 to 100 resources today. But then you can also start building a shared gallery at your team level, or you could have a shared gallery at the community level. And there is a bunch of tooling that is coming out from the PowerShell team around PowerShell Get, which would help with sort of retrieving and updating and installing modules that these DSC resources are. And what, in terms of the, because you have the description of the desired state as itself is a PowerShell script, though it's primarily configuration, and you can check this in along with the rest of your application. So now you get the true flow of config as code where your application is basically, along with it, has the deployment logic, it has a configuration of the end state of the environment, and that goes through your change management cycle, your versioning cycle, and all of the other goodness of like a standard dev application cycle. Yeah.
Am I still on? No.
You had a question.
So can you use that configuration then to set previous environments?
Yes. So one of the biggest benefits is that with configuration being versioned, you can start now being able to reapply the same configuration from like whatever you have as your sort of end state in production all the way back to dev. I'll show a little bit of that when I flip to the other machine. So let's look at this is the state of the art today for release management that Claude just showed you. So what we have here is we have a bunch of agents. If you notice, those the sort of the blue agents that are sitting on all of these machines. And what are these agents doing? So they are effectively pulling all the bits, and they're doing a bunch of deployment logic. And they need to be managed and configured along with that application, and there is some overhead, administrative overhead to doing that. And especially if you're scaling out to thousands of machines, then the administrative overhead gets considerable. So with DSE, what we're basically trying to switch to is a model where the deployment is fundamentally agentless, because that capability will be out, comes out of the box on Windows Server 2012 R2, and you can sort of get that capability as part of your VMs themselves without needing to add an additional state of agent management and configuration. So let me switch to the other machine and give you a little bit of a feel for, sorry. Not able to see this. Switch 8. Okay. One sec, let me. So one other thing that that Claude just mentioned, like if you look at it from a dev perspective, right, what you would really want to do is to be able to be as close to a production state as possible across the stages. So what you typically do is your application, as it goes from the dev to int to QA to prod, you would want to have as close a state to production as you can. So what we are trying to bring to the table in terms of DSE is kind of trying to flip it to the reverse cycle, where you start from production, you take your actual production configuration, And you have the ability to reapply that all the way from to QA and int and dev. So that kind of ensures that you're limiting configuration drift by focusing on the end state that your application needs to reach, rather than sort of an assumed state that that the dev feels that ops is going to see the state of the machine to look like. So you're effectively formalizing the whole notion of what the end state looks like, and that helps you to simplify sort of the dev to ops handoff, right? So let me quickly switch to a demo. Where am I? Try to move this. Just get the okay. It's not too bad, I guess. So one of the other things that we are adding with release management is the ability to easily start using environments in the cloud, because primarily you would want your dev and test environments to be something that you could deploy to Azure, and you would also want to be able to do deployments of this exact same deployment onto your production machine, which might be in the private domain, or it might be in the public cloud. So let me, before we sort of go into the details of that, let me just show you. Let me just show you the story of what this demo is trying to do. So effectively, I am a developer, and I'm trying to set up like a continuous delivery pipeline where I want to release my product in a smooth way, working with my test team and my production team. So what I would do initially is try to basically set up a VM in the cloud where I can sort of put my desired state configuration and I can deploy it and ensure that it works fine. And then I want to be able to hand this sort of the desired state configuration off to my test team, who can then sort of work in a slightly more scaled out, closer to production environment, which might have more than one VM. So I would want to do it in, say, a one box, and then there would be like the test team who would want to do it in multiple boxes that represent multiple tiers, say the web tier and database tier. And then as they go through the stages beyond int to QA, then they start scaling it out further and have a lot more machines that can sort of the same set of things can be deployed to multiple machines. So in order to do this, let me first try to set up I first create the actual virtual machines that I want, and I create a cloud service, a set of cloud services that map to the actual environments that I want to deploy to. So I have like something like Tech Azure Dev, Test, and prod. So let me go back to my release. And in order to bring these environments down here, so all that I need to do is basically specify my Azure subscription. So all I do is I use my subscription ID that comes as part of my Azure subscription, and I need to, in order to secure this connection, I need to provide a certificate key, so a management key. I'll close this. Not that you guys got that and you can use it, but effectively you have the entire import and connection between release management and Azure is just based on this simple link, but you just consume an Azure subscription. So what is interesting about that is as soon as you do that, you now automatically get all the environments that are there in that Azure subscription populated. So the mapping here is basically from the cloud service in Azure to the environment in RM. So this gives us the sort of flexibility of RM being kind of agnostic of whether it's Azure or a standard environment, because the environment definition and the metadata is very, very similar, right? So now as we see that all the environments that I created in my subscription are now available in RM to use. So let's go and look at the test environment. So one of the things that we have sort of, if you look at here, you see that all the Azure VMs that are part of the cloud service automatically show up as servers for this particular environment. And an additional thing that they could do, which is specific to the RM client, is tag these servers. So what you would do is you would say that, okay, I know that my application consists of multiple tiers, so let me basically group a bunch of these VMs as a database tier and group a bunch of these VMs as a web tier. So this is where we can sort of scale these out. You can have like n number of these VMs, like 5 of these VMs being DB, 10 of these VMs being web, and 50, and so on as you go through closer to the production stage.
So the point there is that if I want to deploy to five different environments, 5 different machines, I'll configure it once. And I say, well, use that deployment on the machine with the tag web, and then we'll apply that sequence to all the 5 or 50 machines, depending on the scale you have.
So the next thing is once I have that, now I can start setting up my deployment sequence. It's very similar to what Claude showed, but the key there are a couple of things that are very different. So you get all the great control flow that you'd expect in a deployment sequence. So you can basically put stuff in parallel, you can put stuff in sequence and so on, and you also have manual intervention, et cetera. But the key thing that is not here, and that is a good thing, which I'll talk about why, is the whole set of actions and tools that you originally saw. So the reason for that is actions and tools in the designer are effectively going to be stored as data, right? So you would have data in the RM database that would, and it is not being stored as code. So what we are trying to move from is the notion of configuration data to configuration as code. So what you would see here is a much simpler surface where all you would have are the tags that you define. So for instance, in the test, you would see a bunch of tags. Sorry, let me just go through a definition of the release path just to contrast this before we... I mean, you already just saw this, so I just skimmed through this. But it's just interesting to see that you can map these stages directly to your environments, and the tags that you set are specific to that environment. So you would see that the dev is associated with this cloud service, and test is associated with this cloud service, and now this had a couple of VMs which were tagged as DB and web, so those will flow through in the sequence that I just showed you. So let me go back and open the sequence out. So here you go. So what you see here is there are no actions and no tools. So where do you get all the different actions to create a website and deploy and so on? In order to do that, let me just flip to what might be familiar to those of you who have seen PowerShell before, the DSC portion of it. So what you'd see here is a very, very simple state of the master deployment configuration that I'm using here. So this is something that is... this is primarily the desired state configuration that I'm trying to use. And here, if you notice, I'm defining the data tier itself as a resource. So this ST data tier is actually a DSC resource. So think of the DSC resource as what underlies the actual logic that exists for expressing your intent. And then you have and this is just showing you the the configuration values that you need to do. So if you notice here, everything is parameterized and everything is configurable. And this is slightly different from what you would have seen in the sort of introduction to DSE session that happened yesterday. So what is different here is that this is very, very specific to your application. So what you're doing here is you're writing a resource that is very, very specific to your application that is just bringing together a whole bunch of resources. So let me give an example of, say, the data tier. So how does this work? So what you do is you can compose a configuration consisting of other configurations. So this is kind of like a group of resources that you're just composing together. And you're not, again, writing any imperative code right down to the leaf level of what you're seeing here. The actual imperative code, which does actually the magic, is sitting inside these resources. For instance, XDatabase is something that is published by the PowerShell team, and you have like that internally has all the complexity of how exactly you deploy to database. For instance, a question that a lot of you have in your mind is, how do I incrementally and idempotently deploy to a database where I handle my schema changes, my data changes, I want to do only data or only schema and so on, right? All those combinations. So if in order to do that, different people would have written a whole different set of PowerShell scripts using SQL. So what we're trying to do here is encapsulate all that complexity in the X database resource. And now with this, you get pretty much all of that for free. And like now, because it's part of the community, anybody can start using it, and everybody can start consuming and writing a whole bunch of creation of database just using DSE. So all you have here is, I'm just saying, ensure this particular database is present. This is the SQL server I want. This is the SQL server version I want. And this is a DAC pack path. So DAC pack path is doing a little bit of the magic. It's something that is produced by the database project as well. So that would do all the, you can effectively in your test for the database, it can compare two DAC packs and effectively tell me what has changed, and I can apply it. And if I don't want to do that and I just want to do a very clean deploy along with data, then I can just give a backpack path. It's kind of like a backup and a restore of things. So so we notice here, there's nothing here that's imperative. There are no functions that are being written. All you're saying is that I'm structuring my data tier to basically have these logins. I'm going to have this whole bunch of databases. Similarly, I will do the same thing for my. It would be the identical thing for my web tier, where I would say I want IIS, ASP.NET, copy a bunch of things to create my website, build my application pool, and so on. Right. So it's basically simplifying the way that you express your configuration without needing to know too much about the intricacies of PowerShell. And all the complexity of that is encapsulated inside the underlying resources. And then once you bring those resources together at the highest level to your master configuration, here what you're doing is, because all these requirements, as an ops person, you could just have expressed that these are the only parameters that I care about, and internally I could compose whatever I want and add new like policy and rules and what ports should be open, what kind of logins I should use. I can hide that. So think of this as another layer of abstraction that helps you do that. And another interesting thing that I wanted to show, let me just go back to release management, that I would like to show here is the notion of how this would be applied, right? So if you look at for a deploy.
But where do you use it in release in your flow? Where do you use those files?
So yeah, exactly. That's what I'm showing here. So where would you use? So we just saw this the deploy script that had the stock sort of the data tier and the web tier. So where would you use this in the deployment sequence? Is that you would effectively have you have a deploy action in release management, and inside that, if you notice the deployment path, all that you provide here is the actual script path. So think of this as the structural configuration of an application. And if you look at it across, whether you're using it in dev or test, and even in prod, once you set it up, it would all be using exactly the same master script. So it just uses exactly the script that I showed you. So there is no, this is ensuring that I can deploy across all the stages using exactly the same logic without needing to change my structural configuration of my application. The environment-specific configuration, on the other hand, is something that you might want to tweak for each of your environments. So you might have things that are very, very specific to your environment configuration that you would want to tweak. For example, I will show you, in the case of the dev stage, where I just want to put everything in one box, I might just pull all my configuration across all my tiers as key value pairs. I might even expose like config login and password. I don't really care. I'm a dev doing a one box thing, so I can just put everything here. But if I'm doing something across multiple tiers in a test stage, but I scale it out a little bit more, then I would want to basically be a bit more careful about the kind of things that I add here. So I would have like in my web tier, I would just specify things that are specific to my web tier. I might add some more things related to ports and policy. I might do very specific things around policy to my web configuration and so on. And one interesting thing that you can see here is the notion of install module. So this is something that comes with PowerShell get. So let's say all those underlying leaf node resources that you saw, how would you get them? So basically think of this as there is how would you, if you don't want in your dev and your pre-production stages, you just want the latest version of those modules which internally contain the DSC resources, how you would get them is by just running this install module. So you don't really care where it comes from. It's coming from a shared gallery. And then once you get a little bit more sort of closing down your environment when you're in production and you want to control how you pull your modules, then you could pull this particular module into your build itself, and then you can do something like this, where you just copy it as part of your script to the local machines. So if you look at this, there's an interesting thing here called $applicationPath. So let me tell you how this maps to what we just saw in the main. Just close this.
Little X, just down. Little X.
Ah, there you go. All right. Okay. So if you see here, this is sort of what the test stage looks like, right? So There is a notion of upload in the test stage. So what is this upload for? Because we are using, because there is a lot of scenarios where I'm an RM server and I'm deploying to maybe environments in the cloud or environments in untrusted networks, I would always have the notion of, like, how do I set my cross-domain trust and cross-domain support? So with upload, what we have added is primarily a feature that will help you to take all your builds and put it to a shared a location in Azure storage. And then once you have it, then here all you need to do is provide like the storage account. So you don't really worry about, because you already have your Azure subscription that you have provided. And then you just, provide your storage account. And with that, you'll get your bits automatically going to Azure storage. And all your different nodes, which with the DSC engine, will know how to pull them. So that $applicationPath that you saw there is a special variable that you would use, but I don't know where my build is coming from because that's handled behind the scenes by the release management infrastructure. And then the next aspect of it is, how do I actually do the deploy? And as you saw, we can use the exact same script path, and we use slightly different configuration paths in order to do this particular deployment. So all we're doing here is simplifying your entire actions and tools surface and basically making them all code that is shareable, reusable at broader levels across your team. And now anybody who wants to deploy the stock trader application has a mechanism to do so across multiple stages. And anybody who wants to deploy a database can now do so at a much more global level because somebody has written an X database and there are a whole bunch of PowerShell experts who would start building a whole community of these galleries, and there's a lot of traction around how this gets built, right? Versus if we had it inside as configuration data as a set of tools and actions, then you get the pluggability and it's very easy to, it's much easier to consume, but the downside would be that it is not available as code that you would be able to sort of reuse and share and version and so on.
So do you want to show us how it works? Like a,
sure.
Actually use DSC to do a deployment?
Yeah, so once we have set up the release template, we can just go ahead and, one of the things that we have here is, as I showed you, we have the dev stage, which would go to the one node kind of deployment in Azure, test, which would go to another sort of slightly scaled out deployment in Azure, and then production could be a local environment, but you can still use the exact same script because there's nothing in the script itself that is tied to Azure, right? So you would use the exact same script and the same, you might tweak the configuration a little bit. So let's go ahead and start out a new release. So once I have shock trader define, I can just go ahead and kick out the release. I'm just going to use the release template that I showed you. And I, as you can see, you get the package location, which is based on a build drop that was created. And then you can just kick this off.
Can you kick it off from the web interface too?
No.
At this point, no.
So it's from build manual and not from the web interface.
So let me actually show you. As this is going on, let me try to show you a release that happened a little bit earlier, just to give you a sense of sort of the logging capabilities that exist here. Okay, this one is not very
distinct. So it's going right now.
So as the release is kicked off and it's basically going to go and deploy to dev, and then it's fully automated, so then it'll deploy to stage and to test and so on. This is sort of what happened when I ran the release the last time. So if you look at it, it's auto-deploying. This, it's all automated, so it would have, like, it would do a deploy to test, to dev. It succeeded, then it does a deploy to test. Now, if you look at it here, because we have tagging as well as the notion of DSE, we can actually go and see, okay, in my database, for every single machine, I can go now and look at a log. And if you look at this log, it also gets a bit richer automatically because of some of the capabilities that the DSE engine provides. So because you're doing sort of a get, test, and set, you get a whole bunch of every single resource that is being compared, the test that's happening to see if that resource exists. And if it already exists, then it's just going to skip. So this is kind of the idempotent nature of each of these resources. And that is to a much finer grain, because depending on how powerfully you write the test, you get a really fine grain of idempotency, as I showed you with the database. You get like a whole bunch of interesting compares you can do around schema changes and data changes. And then in scenarios where like for instance, because we added new bits at this point in time, you would say that, okay, if I'm adding any new, in the case of database, it's not interesting, but in the case of web tier, if I'm adding like say new changed bits to the web tier, it would actually show you that those web tier bits are being applied. So you have a start test here. It's just checking if IIS and all these things exist. They all exist, so it goes ahead. But if it finds that, okay, my application has changed and I have something new to use, then I can basically effectively copy them and then I start sort of deploying that application, right? So with this, you get sort of incremental idempotent deployment and you get this whole notion of shareable resources. And you get that idea of how to limit configuration drift by focusing on the end state of the configuration rather than focusing on the assumed state from the dev perspective. Right?
Yes. Thanks. All right, so just take it back.
Yeah.
So thanks. So again, the DSC is a change in the way we think about these things, right? And sort of declarative. If you notice also, DSC gives us a little more on the actual environment management. So it really ties the two. So we'll continue supporting both, but clearly we're making investment on the DSC front going forward as kind of a core Microsoft technologies to do these deployments and environment setups going forward. So we have a number of other sessions. So more deeper example on how to leverage release today, how to use it, and also a little tomorrow, like more complex cases, more detail. So that's the session that we're doing, the first one on the list. And the others are related to DSC, which you can also look at. There was one yesterday. You can look at it from a reference to go look at the
they actually have they have a follow-up of that at 5:30. I can probably update it in the slide.
Right.
They have a repeat session on that one as well.
And there's also a lab available on the DSC that you can go look at. Resources, you can go to Channel 9, TechNet. This will be available on Channel 9. There's also our Visual Studio blog that you can look where we put information about release management as we go as well. And I think at this point, we have just about the time we wanted. We're actually 46 seconds more time than we have for questions. So I'd just like to open up for questions that we might have. Yes.
So when we do things like taking a backup of a website, is there a way to inject a piece of metadata, like a date or something, so that we can keep making new folders instead of overwriting the one?
Yeah, so the question is, when I take a backup, I want to inject metadata. In this case, if you want to augment on it, at this point, you'd probably just take the Xcopy base and augment it, create your own tool. So you can add a tool, and you might just say, well, I'll wrap a PowerShell that takes a copy and adds a date, and then do what you want. So we provide these base ones in the box, but the box is very easy to extend. So you decide your command. It could be an executable or a PowerShell. We see a lot of customers using a lot of PowerShell. So yeah, kind of the basic one, you cannot edit ours, because when we came with a new version, you'd lose your custom. But you can just use it and create your own, you know, better version of it and add it to the toolbox. And now you use that instead of ours.
There's a question there.
Yes.
Can you use the release managers to
deploy
to the Windows
Azure
package on
Yes, you can. Yeah.
If I'm using this to release multiple different products, is there some sort of dashboard that shows me all of my products and what version is in each of my environments for each of those products? Is there something like where at a glance I can see?
Right. So the question is there a place at a glance to see all of these together to see where it is? So that's the first one I showed. That's what we have. It might not be exactly what you have in mind, but we show every pipeline. And then on each of the pipeline, you need to go down and say, well, we show a few metrics, like how many deployments in the week, how many failures. And then you click on it, and then you see the list. So we don't have a what's the latest build on each of them like at one glance, but that's kind of the equivalent we have. It's no big secret. I think Brian talked about it. Like there's a push towards the Ibiza type interface. So as we go, we're basically kind of we'll migrate our interface as the rest of Visual Studio to the next one. So those are good points for us. That will be a good opportunity to add these type of things.
Related to that, then, is there any sort of API where we could build our own dashboard and just pull the information out of release management?
So currently we don't have a supported API, but you can go and actually read the data and create. And some customers created their own web page that reads on it. But we don't guarantee. We haven't changed them, but it might change, so you might have to adjust where you read it from. But it's not very complicated, and again, if we're asked, we also say, well, this is kind of where you can go and get that data. So the list of release you can query and build your stuff. Yes?
Yes, okay. So there are two options. One is...
So the question is, are the DSC, would they be stored in TFS, in source control, would they be part of the build output?
Yeah, so there are two options. One is the notion of, like, I take everything from a shared repository that you can decide at the team level or at the org level, and you pull them dynamically. That's where the install module, which is part of PowerShell get, comes in. But you can also decide to basically put it as part of your build, in which case you just copy, I showed you the copy item from an application path in the script. So you just copy it as part of your configuration specific to your environment into your machine. So you could even mix and match. Like for instance, in the dev stage and the test stage, you might just install module from the shared repository, but that's why it's in configuration. It's not part of the main script. If you look at it, the install module is just part of the configuration. So specific to your environment, you can decide, am I okay with taking it from a non-curated, like sort of non-version system, or do I just control it as part of my source control? So it's up to you.
Yes. Right.
Where does release management integrate it? Does it integrate on the TFS side to the deployment, or I'm just trying to think where
we have some lab management personnel.
So let's repeat the question. So basically, I'll summarize is how does lab management fits with release management at this point if we're using lab management? No integration yet, but it's coming. Yes.
So if I wanted to set this up by sort of like CTO, I don't do it quite myself.
Right. So the question is, what are the licensing requirements? And the basis actually is based on you license the ability to deploy to target servers, and it's based on target servers. So you wouldn't need a license for the IT user. You need approvers and all these guys. They don't need any specific license. You do need a license to set it up, a Visual Studio license as a base, and then you go by the number of target servers you need to go to. And there's a grant of 2 target servers per ultimate. So if you have ultimate, you actually, you know, if you have 10 ultimate, then your first 20 servers are included with your ultimate licenses, which is nice. Yes?
If we have a big file transformation set up, will those get applied to the release manager?
Can you repeat?
If we have a transformation set up for our big files.
Right. Yeah, so the question is, if we have a transformation set up, can we use Release Manager to do them? So the answer is kind of two-way, is you can actually use RM to do it for you. So if you put the tokens on the file, then what you enter in will do the transfer for you. But if you've already done it and you have, let's say, a PowerShell or an executable that does that already and you want to keep using it, then you can just register your transformer, whatever it is, as a tool, and then use it instead of using our mechanism. So yeah, you have the choice there. We see a lot of the customers where they already have some asset, they just add them as a tool, they use a workflow, they use everything, and then they trigger what they have, and then if there were some other automated step, they start using our stuff, and then eventually keep or might slowly redo the stuff that already works. But if or do you have things that work, that deploy automatically, that does a... Often it's not fully manual. It's actually a bunch of little automation with some manual glue around them. And we're kind of going, yeah, your pieces that work well, just add them to the box and use them. It's fine. That's really that mindset of the toolbox.
Can I follow up on that?
Yep.
So you're talking about the web.config transform that are inside Visual Studio, right?
Yes.
Right. Those are a compiled time solution, not really a deployed time solution.
Yeah.
It's that top one.
B349.
It's a very important concept that you have to be able to deal with that challenge of how do I get my code correct in every environment and talk specifically about that.
Okay. So what we were doing that before, now we just have one transform that does the tokenizing.
Okay.
Okay.
And then we found that the tokens were patterns in there, and some of our really complex configurations were simplified by using the new release management.
Cool.
So one transform to do the tokens, and then configurations in the release management.
Absolutely.
All right.
You're describing it great, but there's a good blog post on how to do that.
So we'll continue that discussion. We're out of time.
Yeah.
So thanks, everyone. We'll stay around for additional questions and answers. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you.